Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I am your host, Todd Embley. And in part one of our conversation with Tianxin Xu, senior economist at the Economist Intelligence Unit, we dig into China's macro performance in the first half of 2025 and what the future may hold. Tianxin analyzes Q1's headline 5.4% growth, discusses why the London trade truce between the US and China matters, and highlights what Western media narratives often miss when reporting on China's economy. We also explore how resilient China's economy really is in the face of renewed US tariffs, whether the truce will hold, and how all of this impacts international brands and investor sentiment. For anyone navigating China's economic landscape in 2025, this episode offers a level-headed, data-driven perspective. Enjoy.
There are typically two types of constraints. One is the lack of transmission, because it takes time for on-the-ground situation to be passed on to the ears of top policymakers. And in China's case, the lack tends to be, let's say, 1 or 2 months. But the second is the willingness to roll out support. So in China's case, when we talk about that willingness, there are pros and cons. So pros, you don't really need a lot of legislative fightings. You don't have an opposition party that will oppose to your stimulus decision, trying to, let's say, kidnap your bill. The con is there's still some ideological constraints. Generally, the Chinese government, it favors fiscal sustainability. It doesn't want its public debt to balloon to a very high level. And it is learning, let's say, from the lessons from the US. The US is running a very high deficit and a very high public debt. It is also cautious about the situation in Japan. Japan's public debt is more than 200% of GDP.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Tianxin, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Hi, Todd, and hi, everyone. Thanks for having me here today.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Thank you very much. So where are you in the world that we're recording you from today?
Yeah, I'm from Beijing. Yeah, it's midsummer. The heat and humidity these days actually feels more like Hong Kong. 36 degrees, a bit humid. Yeah, climate is changing. Yeah. Normally, it should be a dry, hot weather here.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the humidity is not that common in Beijing, being kind of as north as it is, really hot, you know, similar to where we are in Canada, really, but usually not humid. That's usually more of a Shanghai, Hong Kong problem. You're right.
Yes. France is also 40 degrees, I think. Yeah. So everywhere is becoming hotter.
Climate change, man. Climate change. All right. Well, we're not going to talk about climate change. We're going to talk about China's economy. And I want to know what your thoughts are on how China's economy has performed in the first half of 2025.
Yeah, I could remember that there was widespread pessimism as we entered 2025. Yeah, especially, you know, with the return of Trump, with the return of the trade war 2.0. Yeah, but it looks like, so we are at the half year stage right now, and it looks like China's economy turned out to be stronger than the general expectations. Yeah, so people are generally assuming a sharp decline exports, yeah, and let's say reduced investments, poor consumption, yeah. So actually, none of these have happened yet. So it brings us the question as to why is that, yeah. And I find, let's say, general three things. First, I mean, there is a stronger and front-loaded government stimulus. Yeah, this is because I think the Chinese government has been highly aware of, let's say, the potential shocks from the Trump presidency. Yeah, and they have been, and they were planning all those kind of responses, as I could remember, at least in mid last year. Yeah, and they were quickly, they were quick to roll out a set of stimulus early in this year. Yeah, for example, consumer subsidies. Yeah, and more government bond issuance for strategic projects. Yeah, and bank recapitalization. Yeah, and so on. These are all done to, let's say, to fend off the challenges from a second Trump presidency. Yeah, and they have been supporting the general, let's say, consumer landscape, the investment landscape. Yeah, so I think that's the very important first first reason. Yeah, the second is China has adopted a very effective tactic in the trade war. So right now we already have, let's say, two rounds of the economic warfare. First round in April, or tariff rate soared above 100%. Yeah, so that's about tariffs, and China didn't lose it. It sort of forced America into a temporary truce in Geneva. Yeah, and there's a round two. It didn't lose because it sort of leveraged its advantage in terms of rare earth production. Yeah, and the control of other sort of key materials. Yeah, so when the U.S. ramped up its own export controls, China responds with its version of export controls. Yeah, and Trump didn't get an upper hand. Yeah, so that's what we see for now. There's the London talk, and there's the work on the, let's say, a framework agreement. Yeah, which is about probably to be finalized very soon. Yeah, but anyway, then probably is a draw. Yeah, the U.S. did not win. Yeah, and so I think this shows that China has become very much prepared compared to, let's say, 6 to 7 years ago during Trump 1.0. China was mostly on the defensive side, yeah, and it doesn't really know how to respond. Yeah, but this time it has a lot of more preparations. It has, let's say, a stronger mentality, but more importantly, it has more tools in its arsenal to counter the U.S. measures. Yeah, and that's the second point. Third point, I mean, starting from this year, early this year, we have seen some, let's say, very significant revelations of technological breakthroughs. Yeah. For example, the rollout of DeepSeek is causing a revaluation of Chinese stocks. Yeah, and the conflict between India and Pakistan, it's revealing the, let's say, the strength of China's China's fighter jet, its military power. Yeah, and we're probably going to see a lot more, including in terms of let's say cars, maybe machine equipment, electronics, and so on. Yeah, so I think throughout this year, all the world is probably realizing and reassessing what China is truly capable of. Yeah, so I think those three factors in combination, they contributed to China's stronger than expected economic performance.
You know, I think if Trump had been listening to this podcast 4 years ago, when we actually did a full episode talking about the production of rare earth metals and how China produced 80% of the world's rare earth metals, he would have maybe known better on that front. It's certainly interesting around what you said about the pessimism. How much in your tenure, and you're still a young man, so it's maybe not that much of a tenure for those not watching on video, but you know, I mean, in your time as an economist, how trustworthy are predictions towards future outlooks for economies? How close can predictions be given the state of the world the way that it is today?
Yeah, I think we are, of course, in the world of volatility. Yeah, and I have already worked for more than 10 years. Yeah, I have been through a couple of things after the global financial crisis. Yeah, and but overall, I would say the entirety of the 2010s, even if we have things like the Euro crisis, or the conflict over Crimea, then it was still sort of more benign than what we are currently undergoing. Yeah, so in 2025, yeah, and in the several years before 2025, we have been seeing, let's say, more extreme events happening on a more frequent basis, right? Yeah, so there's a very sort of full-blown trade war lasting from the first day of Trump's presidency until now. Yeah, and it is nowhere near the end, right? And what else? The Iran-Israel conflict and the Ukraine war are still dragging on. Yeah, so all these suggest we're in the more turbulent world. Yeah, and I have to say that, I mean, we cannot think in the sort of a model we used 10 years ago, or even 5 to 6 years ago. Yeah, and it can be very easy to get wrong. Yeah, I would just use a very simple example, which is, I mean, I think in late last year, late 2024, many investment bank analysts, they were expecting the China to rapidly depreciate its RMB against the US dollar in anticipation of a second trade war. Yeah, this is because during trade war 1.0, one way China was doing is to devalue its RMB, in order to absorb the tariff cost of Trump's tariffs, right? Yeah, but and they're thinking the same mode. They're thinking that the RMB, which is right now 7.2 against US dollar, but their expectation was that RMB can go down just about at maybe 7.8 or even 8 RMB against US dollar. Yeah, but they are completely wrong. Yeah, because, I mean, while China can use a cheaper RMB to fend off the tariff pressures, it has also other sort of considerations. Yeah, for example, what if investors are disillusioned or disappointed by a weaker RMB? Will they want to hold the currency again? I guess not. Yeah, and it is that during such the context of great pressures that China won't actively depreciate its RMB, rather it will sort to preserve the general stability of its currency. Yeah, and that is what we have been seeing this year. Yeah, so in the beginning of the year, it's 7.35. Yeah, but right now it's a tiny bit stronger. Yeah, so I think that is a showcase of how we need to adjust our thinking. Yeah, but glad our team is relatively more correct on that. So we didn't expect a very drastic depreciation. Yeah, so we expect some sort of a big intervention. Yeah, to maintain the strength, the stability of the Chinese currency. Yeah, and we proved to be right. Yeah, although we didn't expect that the currency can be that strong as it is currently doing.
Now, for those of you who are listening and watching us on video, you may have noticed that suddenly the video has changed. We had a bit of an interruption to the recording you were just watching and or listening to. And what maybe a lot of people don't know and will now know is that Tianchen was recording the podcast from the hospital where his wife was in labor. And after that last question, we had to stop because Tianchen got a call or a text message, an emergency bat signal SOS to come to the delivery room. And so between the last question and this question, in the magic of podcast editing, just in that blink of a second, Tianchen, you are now a father. So I just want to say congratulations on the new baby girl.
Thanks, Todd. Yeah, it is one of the biggest moments in my life. Yeah, and a very cute, pretty baby girl. Yeah. So yeah. Let's back. Yes, let's continue. Yeah. Let's resume recording.
As a true professional, baby, yes, amazing, yes. Rest of my life changed and back to work. Okay, so we are going to come in. And we were talking about how difficult it was to make projections. And that's a very apropos place to start again, because I'm actually going to ask you to make a projection. I want to talk about what the listeners should be expecting in H2. And as I know, because we did go down this road a little bit the first time, talking about the projections for policy shifts. So what should listeners expect in H2? And please weave into that the policy shifts that may or may not actually happen.
I assume that's the question that everybody wants to know. Yeah. So we are trying to give our projection. Yes. I'm not guaranteeing that I'll be 100% right. Yeah. But it's just the most likely pathway for how the economy will look like in H2. Yeah. So generally, I mean, we think that the economy is likely to be slower in the second half of this year. Yeah, so there's a general pattern in China's economy, especially after its COVID exit after late 2022. Yeah, so the general pattern is the economy is strongest in the first quarter, maintains the momentum, but slower in the second quarter. Yeah, and the lot of pressures emerge in Q3, yeah, and finally wrap up somewhat stability in Q4, yeah. So we generally think that 2025 is probably no exception, yeah. So when we dig deeper into that general pattern, it is because of a lot of the policies, fiscal stimulus support, they were rolled out in Q1, yeah, and part of that effect is still being felt in Q2, yeah, but there was, let's say, little to no government support in Q3, yeah, and the government was aware of that, became a little bit anxious, yeah, and it rolled out more support for Q4, yeah, so that is to say, China's economy and the intra-year momentum of the economy is heavily dependent on the policies. Yeah, so in 2025, yeah, we already saw, as we talked about earlier, that a lot of stimulus was allocated for the first half. A lot of government bond issuance, including government subsidies for the purchase of mobile phones, for a fridge, for cars, and so on. Yeah, so we're going to see that those stimulus, they're going to be softer in the second half. Yeah, just to use an example, China allocated 162 billion yuan for the first half regarding its consumer subsidies program. Yeah, and it's now we'll allocate 138 billion for the second half. Yeah, so that is naturally lower than in the first half. So less money for subsidizing consumers to buy cars or mobile phones. Yeah, and there's the other X factor, I would say, which is property. Yeah, because since last September, we have seen a general stabilization, improved transactions, better sales across China in terms of housing. Yeah, but in more recent years, in May and June, they have become softer. Yeah, so if we look track those weekly data, then we're able to find that new home sales in China fell by more than 15% year on year. Yeah, so that is actually worse than when we look at the data in March or April. Yeah, so I think that also brings some uncertainties regarding how the government will respond. Yeah, so if the current trajectory continues, then we should be seeing that overall economic growth will slow in the second half. Yeah, so we already had probably 5.2% or 5.3% in the first half. Yeah, and it is probably going to be lower to, let's say, 4.7%. Yeah, in the second half. Yeah, so now let's come to the big question of stimulus. Yeah, whether the government will be rolling out more stimulus. And so, in short, we don't think it's likely for Q3. Yeah, but very much possible for Q4. Yeah, this is because, I mean, in China and probably elsewhere in the world, macro policies tend to be very data dependent. Yeah, depending on what the economy has been doing so far. Yeah, so if you are a Chinese economic policymaker, and in July, what you will have seen will be the data from June, from Q2. Yeah, and that's probably it. Yeah, and you need to base your decision on that. Yeah, and what you have seen is that the economy was doing very well, decently very well. Yeah, and that gives you little need to make immediate decision to roll out stimulus. Yeah, so that's why we think there's a little chance for stimulus in the short term. Yeah, but as we project, the economy will slow in over the course of Q3. Yeah, and probably the pressure will rise in, let's say, August or September. Yeah, and that will provide a window for, let's say, more opportunities when leaders gather again in September or October. Yeah, and they will probably look at the data, and they find the data has become softer. Yeah, and they find they will need to make a decision to be more supportive about the economy. Yeah, so that's my bold guess about the China's economy.
In your decade plus of being an economist and being at the kind of the top of the game, it seems like policy changes around stimulus or other fiscal and other seem reactive. You know, I think plenty of times during, as you answer that question, we talk about the data, we'll look at the data, we'll see a softening in the data, we'll see this or whatever. And then, of course, there's also when policymakers actually can convene to create new policies or decide on new policies. And that how that schedule of convenience by the policy decision makers could also play a part in how this question is answered. But is it usually just reactive? Is it ever proactive? Do policymakers, do governments have the guts to make proactive policy changes with the expectations of what is going to come? Or is it really just most often reactive to what has already happened?
So in my view, decision-making is still overwhelmingly reactive. Yeah, it is not only in the case of China, but also for other parts of the country. Yeah, and the reason is largely political. Yeah, because if you do something that is very proactive, you won't necessarily get appreciated for your, let's say, prescient decisions. Yeah, and But if you see a problem, you wait for the problem to develop, to become, let's say, more severe, yeah, and you intervene, you step in and you make a decision and to turn around things, then you will get appreciated. Yeah. And I can still remember, a decision by the Federal Reserve last year. So I remember, I think in September, or somewhere late last year, the Fed made the decision to introduce a preemptive rate cut. Yeah, because at that time it was, expecting the economy to be to become slow. Yeah, and it is expecting a softening labor market. Yeah, so it made a bold decision to cut its federal funds rate by 50 basis points. Yeah, and that is quite bold. Yeah, but the end result is when we benefit from the hindsight, it probably made the decision too early. Yeah, because the U.S. economy was not that bad. Yeah, and inflation was still pretty much stubborn, and it was actually not the best timing for rate cuts. Yeah, so that might be providing a lesson for Jerome Powell, and right now he's not being very active in terms of responding to the rate cut calls from Donald Trump. Yeah, so that is one of the examples. Yeah, and in China's case, Chinese leaders have always been, responding to, economic pressures. Yeah, but I will say that there is some differences. Yeah, in terms of Chinese leaders have been more willing to lend support to the economy. Yeah. So that is because we now have the uncertainties from Trump, which is nowhere near the end. Yeah, and China also will face some domestic uncertainties. Yeah, domestic pressures. Yeah, and that is why that in this year's government work report published in March this year, Chinese leaders they said they are very much willing to commit more resources to support the economy dynamically, and dynamically means they are very much willing to make their provide more stimulus when the economy looks really bad. Yeah, and I think that is one major difference from past years. Yeah, because sometimes even when leaders they are seeing the economic getting soft, they're still holding back. Yeah, on providing more support. Yeah, and it is driven by some other reasons. For example, the concerns over fiscal sustainability. Yeah, or they don't want to create a very much welfare-rist country, for example.
Are policymakers in China better positioned to be able to make the necessary changes and do it swiftly, given the assumption that they do not need to face the type of political backlash that a government body might face in the West?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I do see that there are typically two types of constraints. One is the lag of, lack of transmission, because it takes time for, on the ground situation to be passed on to the ears of top policymakers. Yeah, because they need to handle so many things in a day. Yeah. And in China's case, the lag tends to be, 1 or 2 months. Yeah. But the second is the willingness to roll out support. Yeah. So in China's case, when we talk about that willingness, there are pros and cons. So pros, you don't really need a lot of, let's say, legislative fightings. Yeah, so you don't have an opposition party. Yeah, that will oppose to your stimulus decision. Yeah, or trying to, let's say, kidnap your bill. Yeah, trying to insert some of its, let's say, own its own
agenda.
Resources. Yeah. So the con is there are still some ideological constraints. Yeah, I mean, generally, the Chinese government, it favors, as I said, fiscal sustainability. Yeah, it doesn't want its public debt to balloon to a very high level. Yeah, and it is learning, let's say, from the lessons from the U.S. The U.S. is running on very high deficit and a very high public debt. And it is also cautious about the situation in Japan. Yeah, Japan's public debt is more than 200% of its GDP. Yeah. And what if the yields of the Japanese government bond rise? Yeah, it might be causing a lot of pressure on the debt or interest payment for the Japanese government. Yeah. And I mean, at least until late 2023, the Chinese government has been very, very cautious about expanding its balance sheet, about borrowing new debts. Yeah, so we are starting to see some changes from 2024. Yeah, the government is willing to issue, let's say, more long-term bonds to support its strategic areas. Yeah, and it is even willing to subsidize to support the consumption of its domestic households. Yeah, so which I think is pretty much positive. Yeah, and yeah. So that is the thing for China.
Isn't it true that actually Japan holds the most U.S. debt?
Actually, not. I think in terms of the overall.
And that's why I asked. I mean, I thought China was second to Japan. And I don't really know if the Middle East plays into this at all. But I thought that I had read somewhere recently in the last few months China was only second to Japan. But I guess I'm wrong.
I think in terms of direct holdings, China should have fallen to second. Yeah, but I mean, over the past decade, China has been diversifying its holdings. Yeah, and that includes indirect holdings. For example, it is holding via Belgium, via Luxembourg, and probably via other offshore financial centers like maybe BVI. Places like that, yeah, and it is also diversifying the types of its U.S. securities holdings. For example, it is starting to hold more agency bonds, meaning bonds issued by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, those types of agencies. Yeah, so it is not China is not raising its stakes on the U.S. Government or U.S. Treasury bonds themselves.
But those that are at the top of those rank of holdings, to me, this creates somewhat of an intertwining of if I go down, you go down too. So I would think that, you know, Japan, China, U.S. are quite intertwined in destiny in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it is because China and the U.S. are still so much sort of intertwined in terms of trade, right? Even if, I mean, the direct trade between the U.S. and China has declined, yeah, but their connections are being, let's say, scattered in Southeast Asia, maybe in Mexico, and so on. Yeah, so the indirect ties have of course, reason between the two countries, yeah, and that is one of the reasons of China still holding a lot of U.S. treasuries, yeah, because China receives a lot of U.S. dollars through trade, right, and it needs to invest in those US dollars, yeah, and the US treasury markets and all the US bond markets is still the largest pool of dollar assets.
How resilient has China's economy been to the US tariffs, and are there vulnerabilities that remain?
I think overall, China's economy has been largely resilient to US tariffs, yeah, which is better than what a lot of people would expect. Yeah. So the first thing is tariff did hit direct US-China trade. So to use some data, China's exports to the US dropped by 34% in May, yeah, because of the disruptions from the 100%+ tariffs, right? Yeah, and that has hit provinces and cities with very large trade exposures to the US. Yeah, so think about cities like Ningbo. Ningbo is in Zhejiang, and it hosts the second biggest container port in China. Yeah, and a lot of businesses there are exporting to the US. Yeah, so I did did some data crunching, and I found that the US was the US accounted for one quarter of Ningbo's total exports in 2024. Yeah, so that's quite a large share. Yeah, but similar thing also holds for some other cities like Suzhou, for example. Yeah, and Shanghai. Shanghai's export exposure to the US is also quite large. Yeah, and when I was in those coastal provinces in May, when the tariffs were still sky high, businesses, they did report some big disruptions. Yeah, for example, they are not receiving U.S. Export orders. Yeah, and some factories, they are suspending their production for a few weeks. Yeah, so that was the situation in May. Now, tariffs have gone down to a bit more than 40% based on our calculations. Yeah, so that is still high, but I mean, it is still possible to do business, yeah, and especially given the lower production cost enjoyed by Chinese factories. Yeah, so if we think about China is still facing a little bit more than 40% tariffs. Yeah. But in terms of the production cost, it can be, let's say, 20% or 15% lower than those produced in Vietnam, yeah, or other places. Yeah, so that means Chinese goods are still competitive in the international markets. Yeah, and the second point is that total exports are not hit that much. So overall, exports in January to May was up by 6%. Yeah, so that is still pretty much resilient. Yeah, and in particular, we have seen exports to non-US countries risen. For example, 6.4% growth in terms of export to the EU, and more than 12% growth in exports to Southeast Asia, yeah, and nearly 20% in export growth to Africa. Yeah, so that is a showcase of the competitiveness to Chinese goods. Yeah, and finally, the third point is that China's domestic economy is currently very, very sizable. Yeah. And the exports, I think it probably now accounts for about 15 to 17% of China's nominal GDP. Yeah. So that is not low. Yeah. But that is not high given the size of China's economy. And that means if China manages its domestic economy well, it can largely fend off the external threats. Yeah, and that is actually what we have been seeing in the first half of this year. Yeah, and When we talk about vulnerabilities, so there are still a couple of weaknesses. Yeah. So for example, one, I think biggest threat is actually China's trade with third countries. Yeah. And we're probably going to see more trade defense measures from those third countries. For example, Vietnam is already levying duties on Chinese steel. Yeah, but also in the EU is very very much concerned about Chinese dumping. Yeah, dumping means you are dumping your goods at a very cheap price to third countries. Yeah, and the EU is concerned because the Chinese goods are very cheap. Yeah, and but the production cost in the US, in the EU is very high. Yeah, so that means the flooding of Chinese goods into the EU will erode the market share of EU goods. Yeah, and so that's why they have been conducting investigations on Chinese EVs. They have been conducting investigations or imposing limitations on Chinese medical devices and so on. Yeah, and we are probably going to see this continuing for a few more quarters. Yeah, because Chinese factories, they are now facing protectionist measures from the US. Yeah, and they are probably have the incentive to find alternative markets. Yeah, and they will be probably more aggressive in terms of exporting to other third markets. Yeah, and this can be a challenge for those countries. Yeah, and when they roll out their own trade defense measures, this will be having pressures on Chinese exports.
I mean, when there's an oversupply or an over-manufacturing, that is the natural way of the universe. I love the quote from Bruce Lee, be like water. When you run into a rock, you don't argue with the rock. You simply find a way around. And so you find other markets in which to sell into. But as the urgency to liquidate an overstock becomes high, pressures financially on cash flow and debt rise, the need to liquidate becomes strong. Therefore, you are willing to lower prices and offer better deals. Countries are going to be wary of an influx of below market cost goods flooding in, which would then be very disruptive to its own industry that is in that industry, whether it's solar panels, for instance, or tires into Canada, or, you know, things like this, everything that is getting hurt just because, I mean, the US was such a strong importer of so many goods, they have to go elsewhere. And then the US, of course, will respond with other measures where they will levy an over 3,000% tariff in Southeast Asia on solar panels, thinking that the Chinese might get tricky and reroute through other neighboring countries to try to avoid tariffs. So then they go and nail those countries as well, annihilating smaller countries, industries in the wake of that. It gets messy. It gets messy for for everybody.
Yeah.
I want to move on and talk about the London US China trade tariff deal. Okay. First question. Do you expect it to hold? And secondly, what are the implications of this deal?
First, we don't know a lot of details about the tariff detail, about the tariff deal. Yes.
But let's make some predictions anyway.
Yes. Yes. What we have been able to see is a very sort of sporadic news that, okay, the US has allowed exports of EDA tools to China, and the US has resumed exports of ethane to China, and China has rolled back some of the rare earth export controls. So regarding your question, the answer is I do think that the deal will hold. So the reason is it has become quite clear that Donald Trump tends to bully the weak, but he fears the strong. And in the case of the conflict between the U.S. and China, Trump started the conflict, through fentanyl tariffs, through reciprocal tariffs, and through some other export controls, especially on AI chips. But he wasn't able to gain an upper hand over China because China isn't afraid of fighting unless many other countries. And China hit Trump's vulnerabilities with precision. So for example, in response to the US curbs on China's access to AI chips, China responded by ramping up its rare earth export controls, and that is causing, for example, Ford to halt its production in its U.S. facilities. It seems to be causing immediate supply chain disruptions in the U.S. While China, it has been facing sanctions for so long. And of course, some companies like Huawei or Chinese tech companies, they're facing the strains due to the lack of supplies of AI chips. But they can manage by, and because they have stockpiled a lot in the preceding years. So they can probably hold on for a little bit longer. But the result is clear. The US is facing very immediate pressure and China is not. To your question, I think the deal will hold because if Trump walks away from the deal, or Trump reneges on the deal, then he will probably face immediate punishment from China. For example, even if China has resumed export to the U.S. regarding those critical minerals, rare earths, it can readily, slow them again due to some, administrative obstacles, and so on. They can readily inflict damage on the U.S. supply chains again, the cars sector, the defense sector, and so on. So I think for Trump, honoring the deal should be the optimal solution. Of course, I don't think he can afford the damage on the U.S. supply chains. I would say that in the end, at least the deal will probably at least hold on for, let's say, a couple of quarters at the very least. We don't know what things will look like in 1 year or even longer, because Trump is so unpredictable. But the deal will at least ensure that he will honor the deal. I think that is for the deal. But of course, he has hit the rock in terms of tariffs, in terms of export controls. But he will exploit other areas to start some new conflicts. For example, we have been seeing that he's the sort of cracking down on the transshipment. Reportedly in the U.S.-Vietnam deal, he's asking the Vietnam to scrutinize transshipment. All those rerouted goods will face 40% U.S. tariffs. And of course, there are some other potential areas of a conflict. For example, we still haven't seen a lot of warfare in the financial battlegrounds. In the form of, let's say, U.S. delisting some of the Chinese stocks listed in New York. There have been some proposals by some U.S. congressman on that matter. Yeah, but Trump hasn't used that as a card. Yeah, so if Trump struggles to find, yes. So if Trump struggles to find other ways to pressure China into some concessions, he might use those stocks as a what?
A red herring.
As a bargaining chip. Yes, as a red herring. Yes.
I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second, and I hope I don't annoy anybody here. Misdirection. Chaos and unpredictability to me seem fodder for the society, yet to me are distractions. It is oxygen for those who want to yell on social media and to ignite and inflame, distract people from the reality of what is the true game. Do you find that? Or would it be safe to say that economists like yourself are very aware of the distraction technique? And are you able to pull some sense from everything that he does that is so insensible?
So sorry, could you repeat the first part of the question?
I guess what I'm asking to rephrase is, are economists like yourself able to stop yourselves? I mean, you're a pragmatic bunch. Economists are typically very pragmatic. They tend to refuse to react emotionally and are very data-driven, both recently and historically, and pride themselves on good, solid foundations for decision-making, not withholding predictions. Are you able to? This is the most noise we have seen anybody ever make. This is the noisiest, most unpredictable person at this level of government that the world has ever seen. Also, given the fact that he has ample platforms that are able to amplify all of his noise. How easy, how difficult is it for you to ignore the noise, not get distracted, and really stay within yourselves, within your industry, within your own data, to really know and see and understand what the true point of a lot of fluff is?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think the important thing is for us to not getting too involved in the news cycle. Yeah, because there can be two pieces of totally conflicting messages in one day or even in 1 hour. Yeah, we have seen that for a couple of times, right, over the past couple of months. Yeah, so I think what we can do is, first try to analyze the behavior of the rational people, rational actors. Yeah, and this is actually where some economic or some other models can help us. Yeah. So I think the game theory, for example, was very effective in terms of interpreting China's response to Trump's measures, Trump's tariffs or his other measures. Yeah. And it can actually date back to some sort of experiment or mathematical competition back in the 1970s. Yeah, and basically a university professor, I think from the University of Toronto, he devised such a question, which is very similar to what China and the US are facing right now. Yeah, and he was soliciting to the broader society or the academic circle for an optimal solution. Yeah. And and the guy that won the prize actually proposed the tit for tat tactic. Yeah. Which is almost exactly what China has been doing now. Yeah. And he submits his results with a mathematical proof. Yeah, and that seems to be at least partly guiding China's reactions in its trade war with the U.S. Yeah, and I think that is a very brilliant example for, let's say, how we as economists can interpret the new world, the new turbulence with some, let's say, old mathematical models. Yeah, they are still being valid and they are still being very effective. Yeah. And for Trump, let's not take his everyday truth post very seriously. Yeah, but let's try to think about his motivations and his constraints. Yeah, but also the power dynamics within his circles, within the broader U.S. administrations. Yeah, and of course, you need to learn more probably beyond the economics. Yeah, for example, you probably as analysts, you also need to learn more about the U.S. law, for example, because there were a lot of uncertainties during the U.S. CIT's injunctions against Trump's tariffs back in, I think, late May. Yeah, and I have to admit that the dynamics related to these sort of legal stuff is out of the, let's say, the knowledge scope of economists. Yeah, so better try to find a way to, let's say, to ask your lawyer, a friend, or try to read some legal books. Yeah, so probably the only way is to, let's say, to keep learning, respecting what you learn from those mathematical models. Yeah, because they are really designed by true talents. Yeah, and they are still providing guidance to the real world.
One simple, somewhat glib question to ask you, and you only can say one word to answer.
Yeah.
What decade in history do you believe it was the easiest to be a really good economist?
I would say...
You don't have to explain your answer. You just have to give it.
Recent history, the 2000s.
The 2000s. 2000 to 2010.
Yes.
Okay, that's it. We're just going to stay there. I was just curious.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.